Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. So a little bit of a ramble today. I just want to discuss a topic that I'm going to be writing about shortly and having another go at playing with, which is energy meditation. I haven't really done the deep dark jumping off the cliff style energy meditation for a few years now because I haven't really felt the need. Did that for years and years and years, but not really been too bothered about it for a while, but I'm just having another go again, just putting my toe in the water, just feeling down into the dark, a few things I want to have a look at, and just wanted to just discuss energy meditation, but also I was just noticing what I was doing yesterday. And this is how it feels. We'd be having a conversation with somebody about Kundalini, and questions were asked about how to stimulate the Kundalini and things like this.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I just, I've never really felt any particular energy movement, not anything very strong anyway, whilst doing physical yoga. It's always been when I've been still. And it's like the stiller you get, the stronger it can be for me. And I was just, because I want to write about this, I've been trying to find ways to describe the internal experience, and it feels a bit like, imagine that you're in a house at night and you don't think anyone else is in the house but you, but you suddenly hear a noise and you think, shit, what's that? Now, this is one of the ways that it feels like. It's, now imagine all your focus would go to that noise.
Yeah, it would,
you'd be, all your awareness, every part, you'd probably even stop breathing. You'd be so focused on that noise. Now, for me, when I go in like that, if I actually want to shortcut straight to just having a bit of an energy blast, that's the kind of thing I'd do. But it's not fearful, like you'd be, you know. But that degree of like one-pointed intensity of the awareness, that's going, it's going right in. But instead of focusing on the noise in the house, you're just focusing right into your body, and you can go into different places. And sometimes it's the whole body at once, and then it will shift and you'll be just entirely in the breathing or in your eyes, usually with the eyes closed, sort of looking into the darkness behind your eyelids.
Yeah.
But usually the breathing or the fingertips. And it can almost sometimes feel like you have grabbed hold of something that's spinning very fast. I'm going to have to pause here because there's a tree which has fallen on the path, and we're going to have to find a way around. And it's like in the, you go into the intensity of the awareness, and it's almost like you almost adhere to the spinning, whatever it is, and start spinning with it. And it's very easy to just be thrown straight out again if you lose your concentration. Now, I know this completely contradicts the not doing thing. But I'm all for that as well, and it's been plenty of times when I've been in meditation, I've been not doing, and I've gone into the same space. But these two aspects, they feel like sort of two sides of the same coin. But sometimes if things are really stuck, I need to do the one-pointed, almost like a laser beam awareness meditation, that really sort of, it's almost like Like, it's just like a real kickstart, you know.
Yeah.
And what seems to happen is, if you can stay with it, and mm-hmm. it's almost like you're dragged down into the dark,
mm-hmm.
I can feel parts of my body lighting up in my awareness,
mm-hmm.
and I become a lot more sensitive to certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, if you've got an area of habitual tension,
mm-hmm.
that you just can't relax.
Mm-hmm. Because you grit your teeth all the time, or pull your belly in all the time, or pull your arse up all the time.
Yeah,
or curl your toes all the time.
Either you're aware of it or you're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. When you do that kind of meditation, you become really aware of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, it floods that that area with awareness and sensitivity, and enables me to gain control back, which means that I then can relax it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because those areas of physical tension which have become habitual.
Because when they're habitual,
they can get kind of quite stuck, can't they?
Stuck,
and become, that, can be, that can become kind of entrenched.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, but the words evaporated.
Yeah.
They do sometimes, so, yeah.
So,
yeah, I'm sure what you're talking about. A lot of people who meditate and do yoga and all that kind of stuff are going to be just going, they're going to recognise it, in other words. I think even just...
But it's a very useful and quick way to bring areas of your body that are problematic in that way into a state where you can decide.
Yeah.
It's like when habitual tension is like the decision is taken from you. It's just it's just clenched and that's it.
Yeah.
But it's like it changes your relationship with your body.
Yeah.
And it's very strong and very weird, and it does feel like you're clinging to something that's spinning very fast, and your whole body feels extremely odd, and it's a very intense physical experience. But then when you come out of it, it's almost like you resurface with it's almost like you've dived down into the a pool of awareness, and when you come back up you bring some of it with you. So it's so useful in many ways, but that's not the only thing that you get. It changes your relationship with your body, but also there's this weird, like, it makes all these like weird mental connections as well.
Oh yeah.
Like your perception of certain things can be altered, and how you view certain problems. Like, for instance, you dive into the pool thinking that something is important. When you come out of the pool,
it's not important.
It's not important anymore.
Yeah.
Or the other way around.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
if meditation's got a use, which of course is debatable, but if it has got a use in the practical world, and for people who are inquiring into their own finding themselves alive. I mean, what it does is it furnishes you with different perspectives. You get this kind of fluidity around perspectives. You say, you're going with one perspective on an issue and you come out with another one.
Yeah.
You can still remember the original one.
Oh, yeah.
You might even still see value in the original one. But you've got this other one as well to juggle.
Yeah.
You know, so in some ways it does enlarge people's understanding, as potentially claims. And some people actually dispute that, you know, they say it's all on the terrain of like emotion or the heart or all this sort of talk. But actually, it furnishes, yes, that's involved, but it furnishes understanding. But it's understanding you get by having a number of perspectives on any issue or any problem or any phenomenon or any event, which you can juggle. they're not necessarily going to synthesize, you know, to produce this super duper understanding. They have to kind of find means of coexisting, probably. So, and in some ways, having extra perspectives makes you realise that you didn't know as much as you thought you did.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if suddenly you're totally convinced of proposition X, a contradictory proposition Y crops up in your meditation, or you bring it out of your meditation.
Yeah.
And you've now got two contradictory propositions that look as good as each other, perhaps.
Yeah.
And you think, well, what the fuck, if this can happen, do I know, what can I be certain about? You know, and I think meditation, of the type you describe, rather than of the kind of over-cultivation type, really is an antidote to dogmatism. Because you can see all these perspectives around something, and you stop wanting to be dogmatic about this or that.
Yeah.
And of course, the seat of our dogmatism is our sense of a separate identity, that we are a separate identity. You know, that is our first dogmatism, you know. And that, of course, is the type of meditation that you're describing. Again, it loosens the grip of that, separate identity. Because you see that the boundary that encloses that identity and makes it separate is actually just this kind of fluid thing that's dancing and moving and shifting
in a
swirling turbulence of other dancing and shifting and moving minds, you know.
Yeah.
The human individual is not separate. I mean, just on a very prosaic level, you're taking food through your mouth. You poop out shit through your arse. So there's a relationship with the world.
Yeah.
You know, when you breathe in, take the oxygen, turn it into CO2 and breathe it out. There's another relationship with the world. You talk to other beings of your own type and make love to them and do trade with them and fight them and love them and embrace them and work together with them. And treat them as friends, and treat them as lovers, and treat them as enemies, and treat them as relatives, treat them as students, treat them as teachers. All of these relationships, to and fro, connecting that individuality, that separateness with the world. It's not separate at all.
When you say it's your own type, you mean just being other human beings?
I mean other human beings, yeah.
Yeah.
So the whole kind of separate thing is an illusion that has to be maintained. You know, and of course, it's an illusion that's favourable to the kind of society we live in. All right. And so there's a lot of pressure on us to maintain it. Also, the thing, the sense of separate identity, as a sense of threat. You know, it's intrinsically fearful, because its existence might come to an end at any time. Because all that has to happen is for that boundary to get punctured. And we know, that people die. People die. So, that's kind of injecting an anxiety into the situation right there at the most basic fact of biological life. So, I mean, yet again, this sense of separateness, in having to be maintained, it's always in tension, you know, because it's threatened by the outside. It's actually also threatened from its own immediate neighbourhood, you know, by things like conscience and instinct, you know, and urges, drives, sex drive, drive to eat, drive to exert will, etc. All this stuff's in the picture. So that poor little separateness is there really under siege. But it's also, not only is it under siege, it's always in a state of denial. But in order to maintain your sense of separateness, you have to be denying all the connections that you have all the time, because they're all a threat to that boundary and keeping that boundary. But in our kind of societies, children are raised and educated to make that boundary the most important thing. that illusory boundary that really is just a lion dancing in a pattern of lines. You know. So it's a sorry state of affairs in some in some ways that meditation can alter, can do something to mitigate. Even though I think the word meditation applies to a lot of things, and some of the activities which are called meditation are actually all about maintaining that boundary and strengthening that boundary.
Yeah.
Of individuality.
If you were going to give a name, you would call that like cultivation.
It's cultivation yoga or cultivation meditation.
Yeah.
Which is always wrapped up with morality, which is always wrapped up with an overarching metaphysical, ontotheological scheme, a religion, if you like. Even though it can be kind of home cooked.
So we've got that kind of meditation, and this that I'm talking about, I would describe
as
energy
meditation. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the name I've always just loosely given to it.
Yeah.
What is that?
I mean, if there's energy meditation, which I mean,
what are the kind of meditations?
What you were describing as energy meditation. There is familiar to probably all of the world's meditative traditions, you know, certainly the ones that have got like that are, you might say, yogic, you know, which spreads very far and wide into Sufism and Taoism and Vajrayana and so forth, and has got modern variants as well. You know, there is in that within those traditions, there's a lot of energy yoga or energy meditation, as you've called it. Which is to do with, fundamentally, it is to do with drawing awareness into focus. And it's to do with applying technique in order to fill the body with energy. In other words, to fill the felt lived experience of being embodied, which you are connecting with in order to meditate, to make that experience into one of being brimming over with energy and vitality and life force and fire, you know. But that's usually the result of technique, and it's nearly always a part of the technique to employ what's called a focused awareness.
So do you think what I was doing there was actually employing a technique?
Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine it probably be the most minimal technique that one could employ.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is basically just using the awareness itself. Well,
you and I have been hanging around a long time, you know, and I would think naturally try and be minimal in technical application. It's the way you work with things anyway, you know, and it's actually a bit of luck on your part, I would say, that you realise that has to be minimal. Now we've talked a lot about like all these kind of forcings, you know, ways of forcing it all or deliberately destabilising the system in order to get some imagined altered state or something like that, you know. And we spoke about that, how counterproductive that is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great if you want visions and stuff like that, I'm not against.
I mean, sometimes it can be useful, because if I want to, I know that I could quite forcibly. Yeah, I know. There's a lovely heron just in front of us. I know that I could just quite forcibly just slam myself into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, hurl myself off the cliff if I wanted to.
Yeah, that's right.
And just fall right down into the dark. This, as I said, this does slightly go against the. Hey, just letting it be.
Yeah, yeah.
Travelling light kind of thing.
Well,
I do find that it is useful to be able to do it, because sometimes I do feel like I need to.
Yeah.
Like this, it's a shortcut.
It's medicinal.
To certain things that I need to know, and medicinal as
it's
well.
Medicinal,
yeah.
I mean, one way of looking at this, and some people. Do seem to. I mean, you can pick this out in some of the literature and stuff like that. But I find experientially that it's true, at least for me. But if you want to do like this kind of letting be thing, letting be, you know, it's a bit like bit like those techniques which you say, don't even bother to meditate, everything's cool, just you're just walking through the mandala.
Yeah.
You know, the beatitude's there, and just settle into it. And you know, as you know, I have a lot of sympathy for that, because I see, also because I see what a two-ended stick the application of technique is.
Yeah.
And then ultimately it's self-defeating. But you could, for some people, you can do that forever and nothing will happen. You live in the same dull, boring world by letting it be. You know, there's no beatitude or anything. You know.
So sometimes maybe having a little kickstart could be useful. Well,
again, these traditions I'm talking about, what they say that if the letting it be meditation, the meditation of non-meditation, it's cold and icy and grey, it's because it's got no energy in it. Because what those traditions are wanting to show us is the sparkle of the world, you know, the flame of the world. They want to see the glory of the world, macrocosmic and microcosmic. This is what the best of the commentators want for us, you know. And so you get complementary pairs of energy meditation and letting it be meditation.
Yeah.
The energy meditation is the more technical, usually, even though ultimately, if you really crack this koan of doing nothing, because you can't do non-doing.
Yeah.
You know, but non-doing isn't doing nothing. That's the koan. It's a koan. It really is, well and truly a koan.
Yeah.
And in the solution to the koan, everything basically, all tension drops away. Yeah. All boundary drops away. It's not like boundaries disappear, but they show themselves from the perspective of the dance. It's simply beautiful swirling patterns in the field, which we call existence and consciousness. What they are. So actually, you know, if you can really not do, your energy awakens, because the suppression of our energy is something that we have to deliberately maintain. In fact, the suppression of our energy has to be something we have to deliberately maintain to remain socially acceptable and sane in the terms of the world. It's exactly the same process that we have to use to keep our boundary, our illusory boundary, our little fortress of identity, to keep that intact. That's what we have to do. It's work. It's suppression. And stop doing it. Or if it stops happening, the whole thing happens at once. You know, the energy meditation and the consciousness meditation, or if you know the non-doing meditation, just merge into one. Practically. In the practical world, all these people like myself are saying, "Oh, technique's crap. Technique only produces a result, you know." And the ego can't unseat itself, because it just recreates itself in the process in a more preposterous form. We know all this, you know. People like me who say this kind of thing, at the same time, we want to be practical, and you know this. You want to be practical. You know, if you're wriggling too much when people ask you questions, they get nothing out of it. You know, so yeah, energy yoga. But I would say that you are on the right tracks, as far as I can see, by saying, well, I keep the technique light, I keep it light, I don't force, I don't try and.
Like not doing anything, but very intensely not doing anything. Yeah. With great awareness,
yeah.
I would say.
Well, it's the thing about it, as I said, you know, it does have, an energy meditation needs a focused awareness.
Yeah.
And that is a definite doing. Some kind of point of will has to sort of operate for that to happen.
Yeah.
But with practice, you can do it with a very light touch.
But with that, the will thing, it's like, it starts off like that for me.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, yeah, I will take a few steps back and then deliberately run as hard and fast as I can towards the edge of the cliff and take a big flying jump out into the dark.
Yeah.
But after that, there's no...
It's its own thing,
you know, there's no will then, because I've just surrendered myself to it.
To gravity,
but to start off with, I deliberately take the jump.
Yeah.
But with the other kind of meditation, which I call like a relaxing style meditation, I have found that sometimes it's like these two things are on a circle. I can start off just doing the you know, relaxing everything, and suddenly find that I've gone through the relaxing stage and been catapulted into this highly energetic state where I'm whirling around and it's like thrumming through my body and it's really like almost painful. And other times where I have taken the deliberate leap down into the dark and, mm-hmm. and gone through all this turbulence and just like drifted mm-hmm. down into this relaxed state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they're not mutually exclusive.
No, they're not. I mean, as I said, the traditions that play with this stuff, of course, they keep pointing out that they're complementary, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm wanting to add that nuance there that...
But you do need to be able to do both.
That you have to get this light touch with any sort of technique, you know.
Yeah.
No, well, I can say I've never done, I wouldn't say never, but mostly haven't done energy meditation, though I've had a lot of experience of energy meditation, because energy meditation has just happened, right?
Yeah.
And when it's happened, and then there is, you know, a spacious meditation, you know, or a non-doing meditation, which awareness is spacious and not focused, because it's relaxed. Focus is a little bit of tension and a bit of work. Yeah, consciousness meditation, spacious meditation. As I say, you don't have any focus. It's very spacious, but that then is full of sparkle. Having had a spontaneous energy meditation, you get spontaneous mind meditation. Some people call it, or relaxation meditation. You've called it. Is then has the sparkle.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of in that sparkle, in that aesthetic delight. The goodies are lurking in there, you know.
Yeah.
They're having a party, and even though, as I say, you know, if technique includes things like wanting this stuff, of course it precedes, you know, we're in this koan with having to do nothing and something at the same time.
Well, I think intensity of just pure awareness is about as doing and not doing as you can get.
It's a good phrase.
But that's with the analogy of the house at night thing.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the best ways I've come up with, because it's just a real world experience that probably everybody's done.
Yeah, it captures
everybody. Yeah. Everybody has had that experience of intense focused awareness.
Yeah.
Before.
Through something unexpected happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they'll know what I'm talking about. It's almost like laying a trail of breadcrumbs back to that experience and then using it in your meditation.
Yeah, I think it's always, if you're trying to talk to people about this stuff, it's always useful to have these concrete examples which people recognise.
Yeah.
Just people in general.
That's an easy, simple one.
Yeah. I mean, what you capture with that story of, you know, somebody you're annoyed in the house, is that a kind of hyper arousal?
Yeah.
You know.
It's like your whole body just sensitizes immediately to it. And it's like, it's very fast.
Yeah, it is very fast, yeah.
And as I said, you probably will stop breathing.
But what you're hitting on there is another perspective or another toolkit. Related to the energy stroke, non-doing meditation toolkit, is another toolkit that you hit on by appealing to something that most people can recognise in order to, as you say, lay the trail of breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
And this is a part of your conversation with people who talk to you about this stuff.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, both you and I are in that position. I mean, that's a whole other story. But this other thing I'm talking about, is precisely the being with those kind of phenomena, those kind of phenomena in everyday life of intensity. And it's like the passion of life is enough for our meditation. You make the passion of life your meditation.
Yeah.
And you, if, and in that kind of vein, you tend to like the intensities. And because the intensities are able to provide this other perspective. And this perspective again, in which the boundaries around the identity seem a lot more fluid and a lot less binding and a lot less in need of defending endlessly, just by engaging with the passion of life in an open and conscious and sensitive way. And of course, you know, some energy meditations, of course, as you've pointed out, are just very useful for developing that sensitivity.
Yeah.
Even though I don't like any talk about development in this realm. I mean, you can go straight to this stuff, you know, some people definitely don't have that much trouble just going straight to it.
Yeah.
In which the two sides of the coin are present at the same time, and the energy's there, and the deep ease is there, and the spaciousness is there, just in one go, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that because there are fewer detours. Even though, of course, ultimately there are no detours. if you say to yourself, well, there are no detours, that enables you to use the passion of life. Use being the wrong word here, nothing is instrumental, you know, but to be with in totality. And in that hippie intuit way, into the passion of life.
Yeah, so we're not using anything they haven't already got.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah.
The intensity of awareness is like available to everyone.
Yeah, of course it is, because human life delivers it endlessly.
Yeah. But also, to use a slightly dramatic statement here, that kind of energy meditation where you just abandon yourself to the dark like that,
as
this dramatic statement is the cure for insecurity.
Yes.
It's like pretty hard to be all self-conscious and insecure and fluttering.
Yeah.
And quivering after you've been through that.
I know, it all kind of pales a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's just
You end up not giving a shit, to be honest.
Yeah. Sometimes you go into that space really worried about something and you can come out and it has literally gone.
Yeah.
And you could be kind of sort of confused, almost like you're looking around inside yourself thinking, where did that go?
Yeah.
And looking around and it's just really not there anymore.
Yeah.
The car. That's nice. It's like travelling even lighter now.
Very light. Very light.
But at the same time, boundaries are like dissolving, there's a funny sort of thing that happens, is that somehow it increases your ability, perhaps because there's less distraction. I don't know why, but increases your ability to make decisions and be very sure and repeating myself, but just to be very clear and decisive.
Mm.
So you don't come out when like in a quivering mess. Oh, what's real? I don't know. What's this? Maybe this and maybe that, and you know, and you know, sort of all over the place.
Yeah.
It actually makes you a lot more certain.
Yeah.
If you're gonna make a decision, you are thumpingly and you're very solid, you're completely there with your decision.
Mm-hmm.
You're not flapping about at all, which you'd think
you ought to be flapping about.
Yeah, if you've got loads of
perspectives and you're not quite sure how you choose between them, or if you try and synthesise them, or what you're supposed to do, we're suddenly finding that your one dogmatic perspective don't cut it.
Yeah.
Or at least there are some others which are as good. You'd think that would make you incredibly you'd be like Hamlet, you know, to be or not to be, you know.
Yeah.
You'd be like that.
You'd be agonising over every little thing because it's like, oh, but it's amazingly not like that.
No.
Maybe because, you know, the insecurity is dropped away, and that's the thing that was always nagging at you and tugging on your sleeve and pulling you back.
There's a lot of it about. But it's a part of the passion of life, which I think is kind of, again, this isn't quite the right word, but usable, you know. I mean, there is a pragmatics of meditation, yeah. There's a pragmatics of yoga. There's a praxis. And it's a pain in the arse. And as I keep saying, you know, get out the loop of doing on all this stuff, you know. And at the same time, there is, and there has to be. Because human beings are hopeless. We're hopeless. You know? And that's why we got that shit.
Well, let me just butt in with a question. Just out of interest, because one of the things I want to do for my book is to interview other people about their experiences.
Yeah.
How does it feel when you're doing energy meditation for
well,
you?
Well, as I say, I don't really.
Or in the past, maybe when you first experienced it, what was it like?
I think my attempts just to kind of do it and follow the instructions and do it didn't really produce very much.
Were you following instructions like from somebody, or were you just like working with a book or something to start off
with?
Well,
you know, once back to people and all the rest of it, you know, and as well as reading and all the rest. But I did find, you know, because of the doing, there's that tension of doing, and I could kind of lessen that a bit, you know, and I did get stuff go on, you know, but. But when it happened, and even though energy meditation, you know, traditionally and actually is where you get the most elaborate and techniques. Nevertheless, for me, when it's been potent and a vivid and transformative experience. It's been something that's more or less spontaneously happened, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that was my first experience, you know. was a real spontaneous walking through the shopping centre type one.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think once the energy is cut loose,
yeah,
it's out the cage. It's then very easy, you know. I keep saying this, you know, one deep breath.
Yeah, you can be off. It's funny, you can decide, can't you?
I'm anybody's.
Like I can, because I know some people who've been having really strong Kundalini movement, and it's, you know, it can be incredibly wearing when you have like too much. And, you know, they've asked questions like, well, how can I stop this?
It's cruel to laugh, but I couldn't help it.
We have had this question quite a few times, and I've tried to.
It's not our fault.
Yes, I've tried to help people, because there are times when you really think, well, this person could really do with the rest, and I felt that like myself sometimes.
Yeah.
In the past. Because, you know, I mean. Human beings, we're headbangers, aren't we? We love sensation.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the playground. What have we got? Swings, slides, roundabouts.
Yeah.
Because we love this physical sensation.
Yeah.
The big dippers and roller coasters. Yeah. And we're bonkers.
A war.
We love that stuff.
War. Young men go to war for precisely this reason.
Yeah. Well,
they do.
Yeah,
honest
some
to God.
Of them do. Some of them don't want to.
I'm not saying it's the total cause of war, but there is an element in war whereby blokes want it because they want the extremity.
Well, that's partly like, you know, maybe video games where they're all shooting. Yeah,
maybe they want to prove themselves and all this.
Yeah, the Kundalini experience is a bit like the energetic equivalent of being on a roller coaster. Sort of how it feels.
It's the energetic equivalent to going over the top at Passchendaele in 15 or whatever.
Yeah, so human beings, we love these strong sensations. So when you get a bit of a taste of Kundalini, a bit, well, you know, like we both have, both like, oh, let's, like, you want to get on the roller coaster again, don't you? Want to have another ride? Yeah. It's kind of interesting. It's like, wow, this sensation is amazing. Yeah. And you know, you kind of, well, you want to play with it, you want to explore it, you think, oh,
sure do.
Yeah, you know. So there's been times in my life when I have overdone it and it's really made me tired, and it takes quite a lot of energy to do it, you know. So you can feel a bit, I don't know, worn out. So that's something to watch out for, you know.
Moderation in all things, dear listeners. Yeah. Including first, moderation.
You do really want to play with it when you first discover it, because it's so fun, you know, in a way. And we are just like ridiculous headbangers as human beings when it comes to joy of sensation.
I think that's one of the great things about us.
Yeah, but the question was, if this is all coming back to the question, how can we stop it? You know, if it's going and going and going, and we're completely worn out, or we can't function actually in life anymore because it's happening too much.
You've got to relax.
How can we stop it?
You've still got to relax.
Yeah. Now, relax. I now can stop it if I want to. I have this thing where sometimes when I'm going to sleep, it will start, and I know that if I just let it ride out, I probably won't sleep all night, and I'm going to feel terrible the next day. So I decide to stop it. So I'm trying to think of a way that I could describe that in a bit that would be helpful for people who feel the same, like they might need a break and want to pause for a while.
Well, that coalition of wills to power, which is denoted when you use the word I, gangs up on the rest and just damn well takes control, like a despot in your psyche.
Yeah.
Because I was tempted then to say, well, who stops it?
Yeah.
You know, I'm envious of you because I've got no control over anything. Whatever I is.
Yes.
You know, I don't want to be like fussy like that, you know.
But when you're at the point of knowledge of physical damage, which I have been in the past, then you know, my will to powers gang up together and say, right, no more of this for a while, time for a rest.
That's the organism's will to survive, mate.
Yeah.
That's Eros.
But I know some people, unfortunately, who
you can get into
really
a mess.
Needed to be able to stop it and couldn't.
You get a lot of suffering.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to think of useful I could say here that would help people to stop it if they needed to.
Rest.
Yeah.
Exercise.
Doing something good, really boring.
Good diet. Just trying to be sensible, inverted commas, for a bit, will generally get you to a level whereby you can kind of get on with your life. If you kind of get like a premature or I don't know what the word would be. Just a something happened that you think spiritual, inverted commas, but which is kind of pretty painful. Yeah.
Yeah. I almost see it as like, did you know a lot of people, when you come to do the corpse posture in yoga, they just fall asleep?
Yeah.
Now,
how do they do that?
I don't know. I see the, say we're going to use this analogy as it's a road. We start off going down the road towards meditation. Now, the beginning of that road is also the road to sleep, or just generally relaxing.
Yeah.
But often sleep. It's like the
sleep takes
and
over
it
you.
Starts off the same road, and then it forks.
Yeah, that's right.
If you go off down the right-hand fork,
you
go
to
off
sleep.
Into meditation, and if you go off down to the left-hand fork,
you get to sleep.
You
get
to sleep.
Yeah.
Now I think it takes practice to recognise when you've got to the fork and to decide which one to go down.
Yeah, I mean that's a time-honoured meditation. It's in the Vigyan Bhairava-tantra and similar tantric text in the Shiva Agama. And it just generally along the lines of, if you can, you know, when you're falling asleep, catch the bardo.
Yeah.
Catch the point where sleep meets non-sleep, the absolute razor's edge, And that's a doorway into the Bardo, or, you know, or into the Dharmakaya, into the great spacious field of awareness. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Similarly, waking up, if you can do it.
Yeah.
And any in betweens. Once you can do that, you realise that anything that's in between. Anything that's in between can be used.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, and of course, that is in between the out breath and the in breath. Between the in breath and the out breath.
Yeah.
And actually, then between this moment and this moment.
Yeah.
And this micro moment and this micro moment and this micro micro quantum size moment and this micro micro quantum size moment. So, you know, you start off with a case of one, the gap between wake and sleep, and then you generalise that into the gap between anything and anything, and then you realise that moments have an interface with the, each moment has an interface with the next, the previous moment and the next moment. In that kind of rhythm of time and existence, and you realise that, and then of course then it's everywhere, isn't it? Everything's a Bardo, everything's an in-between.
Yeah.
Everything's a transition. Everything's a gap. Everything's a fork in the road.
Yeah.
That you can use, you know, into meditation. But it's great to start it with the sleep thing because you can kind of...
That's the first one you learned.
I'm kind of basically in the habit of that. I don't sort of think to myself, oh, I'm going to apply this meditation. I've just been in the habit of using that moment between wake and sleep. For as long as I can remember, to be honest with you, but it's just a habit, I suppose, or it's a part of the set of habits which is me. Yeah. But it's great because it's there again. You see, it's using the passion of life, it's using something that occurs. It occurs every day. You go to sleep every night. It occurs every day. Yeah. And like I say, once you get your head around it, you realise it's just occurring all the time.
Yeah.
And that opportunity is there, whatever. But it's great because it uses what we've got and it uses what anybody can recognise. I mean, I do probably frequently. I use Cook's posture, you know, Shavasana in yoga classes, and I've done forever. I've always been a fan of it. I just like it, you know. But it's every now and then I remind them of that, you know. I say, well, look, you know. You have to be, it's funny because you say, don't go to sleep.
Yeah.
3 seconds later,
they're all asleep.
You've put the idea in their head. If you don't say it, maybe only one will fall asleep, you know. If you do say it, because you said the word sleep.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Just the word sleep will do it, you know.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
It is a bit disappointing after you just had a wonderful class and you look round and 10 minutes later, because you can tell by the way that they're breathing, they've all just gone to sleep.
Yeah.
Completely missed it. They missed the fork in the road totally. Yeah.
Well, it's like a lot of these things. It's dead easy. All of those meditations are absolutely easy. Because they work with what is. They work with what we've got. They work with what's common. They work with what we can all recognise.
Yeah.
But for being easy, it makes them elusive. The more kind of like grunting, hard labour, cultivation styles of meditation, they're not easy, but you don't have the problem of the exact kind of right amount of pressure, if you might call it, which makes it elusive, you know. They don't have the problem of elusiveness. A whole load of other bloody problems. But there you go, it's all good fun, isn't it?
So perhaps if somebody does want to stop and have a rest from energetic poking.
You have to sort your habits out. And which is what Gopi Krishna basically found out. He's got himself a really regular life. You know, Hatha Yoga. Plenty of Hatha Yoga, get strong. Actually, one of the original reasons for Hatha Yoga was to strengthen the body. To deal with this stuff.
I certainly feel like, because my first 2 years of doing yoga, energetically not a lot happened, but I did really quite physically strong yoga because I was young and fit then.
And
I do feel that was tremendously useful to help me through what was to come.
Yeah, I mean it definitely helps. strong, fit, healthy bodies helps.
Yeah.
And it's you know, you can hack it, you can handle it. Actually, because you have an abundance of energy anyway, just from being healthy and fit.
Yeah.
It's an abundance of energy, that's what that is. So you know, you can hack it, because the frame can hack it. I mean, not to say, I don't want to get into this kind of fascism which says, you know, if you're old and arthritic that you can't meditate. You can. In fact, the end of life, it's a great time to meditate.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you've got your marbles, of course it is, you know. You know, when the Grim Reaper's on the horizon for you, you are immediately just drawn to meditation, just by the fact that, you know, that you're aging and the time you got left less and less and less. You know, so you.
That in itself, actually, that sense of that time's running out is almost the same as the being in the house and hearing a noise.
Yeah.
As well,
yeah.
That kind of like draws your awareness very into quite a tight, like a small point, doesn't it?
Yeah. So I don't want to get into, as I say, I don't want to reiterate the fascism that says it's only the young, fit, and beautiful that will.
Oh no! Will absolutely not.
Will chase meditation. It's just not true. You know, and you've got to be able to do it when you're crocked.
Yeah.
And in fact.
Well, actually, to be honest, when I've been the most crocked in my life, that's when I've done the best meditation.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've actually come to the end of our walk now, and it is starting to rain, so we've been quite lucky so far. So some useful thoughts in there, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks for listening.